Did you know that just over 100 years ago, in 1919, a woman was the de facto president of the United States? President Woodrow Wilson had suffered a blood clot that caused paralysis, partial blindness, and brain damage, and for the remainder of his term, he was totally incapable of meeting with lawmakers, governing, or performing the duties of the presidency. The First Lady, Edith Wilson, stepped in and assumed his role, controlling access to the president and making policy decisions on his behalf. It was in August of 1920 when the Tennessee House of Representatives voted 50-49 in favor of ratifying the 19th Amendment, establishing the right of women to vote. We continue our monthly series in this centennial year of ratification of the 19th with co-host, University of Kentucky History Professor Kathy Kern.
My guest today is Dr. Vanessa Holden, who's Assistant Professor of History and African American and Africana Studies at the University of Kentucky. So welcome, Dr. Holden.
Hi. Glad to be here.
Your research is on gender and slavery in the antebellum South, and I'm wondering if you could help our listeners understand how enslaved or newly emancipated women express themselves politically or thought about the right to vote.
Sure. I think that it's a common misconception that during the period of American slavery, that African Americans were barred from having a political life. In reality, African Americans, both free and enslaved, expressed their politics and political opinions both through their actions and through a very active political activist culture. Particularly in free Black communities in the North. African American women were an integral part of these communities, so it wasn't just that free Black men had politics. Everybody had a politics.
So free Black communities in the North, I'm thinking probably one of the most important suffragists of American history is Sojourner Truth, even though she might be seen primarily as an abolitionist, but she was so important to the history of the women's rights movement.
Oh, yes. And a lot of people don't know that Sojourner Truth lived in upstate New York. Her first language was Dutch. And her work as an abolitionist overlaps significantly with her politics around citizenship and the rights of women, that she's a significant advocate for women's rights, even as she's advocating for abolition.
So how important in the history of the 19th Amendment is the role of the 15th Amendment, in which the federal government prohibited states from denying the right to vote based on a citizen's race, color, or previous condition of servitude?
The 15th Amendment is passed during radical Reconstruction, a period of time when the federal government is radically redefining itself as able to do things like decide on voting rights, decide who gets to vote, decide who is a citizen, to make a decision about whether slavery is or isn't legal everywhere. And that radical moment comes out of decades of radical activism. And it's very hard, especially in the earlier period of the women's rights movement, to separate out who is an advocate for abolition and what is the abolitionist movement, and who is an advocate for women's rights. But many of the women who go to Seneca Falls in 1848 come out of the abolitionist movement. And the vanguard of that movement are African Americans who are advocating for abolition from the moment of the founding of the nation and from well before. So many white abolitionists are actually learning activists and activist tactics from African Americans. And the same goes for women, that white women are learning from the activisms of Black women. And they're actually coming up in a movement in which Black women are incredibly active. There were a lot of high hopes post-Civil War that maybe because of the ways that women served their country so valiantly, that they contributed to things like sanitation efforts, like the Freedmen's Bureau, that this would demonstrate that they should, in fact, get the right to vote. And there's a huge letdown for a number of women's rights activists when the amendment makes clear that it's for men.
Right. I was thinking, as you were saying that, that the Civil War was so many American deaths, people really thought this was an opportunity to reforge the nation and to make it live up to the ideals of the founding documents, right? And that all inequalities, if we were going to fix some inequalities, let's just go ahead and fix them all in the period of Reconstruction.
Oh, yeah. And there is a huge letdown, and there are serious racial fissures where certain women's rights, white women's rights activists are furious that Black men who were recently enslaved and have little or no education will be allowed to vote by virtue of their biological sex. And they, fairly well-educated, middle-class women who fought for abolition, are still going to be barred from doing so. And there's some pretty deep hurt between Black and white women's rights activists because of the role that race plays in how that amendment comes to be. Interestingly, though, the broader story of women's suffrage is pretty haphazard state by state. In Kentucky, for example, women who were heads of households and taxpayers as early as 1838 had the right to vote on tax and education issues in parts of rural Kentucky. So a full decade before Seneca Falls, certain women in Kentucky have a right to vote. In 1894, women win school suffrage in Lexington, Covington, and Newport. And so the ability to vote on issues pertaining to schools. And then in 1906, the state legislature takes that right away because they're worried that African-American women who are included in that earlier law will elect too many Republican school officials. So they'll take away control from Democrats. When women win that right back in Kentucky in 1912, they win it back, but with a literacy test. One of the hallmarks of Jim Crow policies, literacy tests for voting rights. They win it back with a literacy test to hopefully bar Black women from taking advantage of very limited voting rights. So the broader story, state by state, there are all these moments where women do have suffrage and Black women are quick to do their best to take advantage of those moments and hopefully make their voices heard.
But you raise such an important point, Dr. Holden, that it is not just a march of democracy where more and more people get included in the electorate and get included in having the rights of citizens. We also have moments where people lose the right to vote, as the example that you just gave, where Black women lose the right with those literacy tests. And it's also a question about the relationship between federal power and state power, right? So some states are further ahead, and it's a complicated history. It's not simply, oh, women didn't have the, no, women were voting up till 1920, then they all get to vote, right?
Yeah, I think that it's also important to remember that before about the 1830s, the early 1830s, most states had restrictions on voting rights that pertain to men. I think, at least when I work with students, a lot of them have the idea that all white men could vote. And in reality, most of the early states in the nation had property requirements and wealth requirements for voting. And with the expansion of the franchise to all white men, universal white male suffrage by roughly the 1830s, many states that adopt a policy that opens up voting to more men explicitly constrict voting for other groups of people. So, for example, in New Jersey, fairly early on in the nation's history, women with the right amount of property have the right to vote. That's taken away from them in the early 19th century. In some areas, free Black men have the right to vote, but when the franchise expands in the middle of the antebellum period, laws are written that explicitly bar them from taking advantage. So it's exactly like you said, it's not a, you know, linear story of progress. That often in American history, when democracy expands for one group, it means the explicit restriction of democracy for other groups.
As you were saying, many people don't understand the extent to which the suffrage was really seen as a privilege of the wealthy elite in the early part of our nation's history. And that story of how the electorate opens up to white men who have no property state by state is still not part of our national narrative, not the way we think about ourselves as a country.
Exactly. I often do an exercise with students where I have them self-identify and keep their hand raised as long as they can. And typically, by the time we get to the property requirement, everybody's hand is down. And in a lecture hall of 200 people, having that visual of looking around and realizing that none of them would have the right to vote in the era of the early republic really drives home that the Jacksonian era in the 1830s is the end of a really hard-fought march for an expansion of suffrage, or even tying suffrage to citizenship, that it's seen as such an important piece of being a citizen is a political social idea that develops and has fought for over time. And I think that's why it's so important to think about the ways that African Americans are influencing American political life before emancipation, that people who live in a society where it isn't true that all white men automatically have the right to vote are actually fairly adept at using other means of making their political voices heard. So Mum Bett, a woman who changes her name to Elizabeth Freeman, her court case is a way that ensures that all African Americans in the state of Massachusetts are guaranteed freedom by Massachusetts' state constitution right after the revolution. She doesn't have the right to vote, but she's able to use other means with the support of white allies to drastically affect the political position of African Americans in the state of Massachusetts. The same goes for the Free Black community in Philadelphia, that they managed to found Black institutions that support Black life and work very closely with white abolitionists to affect change in the nation. And even in slave states like Kentucky, African Americans are making their voice heard, not through formal political protests, but often with their feet. Kentucky is home to some of America's most famous enslaved people because it's home to some of America's most famous fugitive enslaved people. That African Americans are constantly advocating for their freedom, even if it's not through formal political channels.
Well, that's a really good point, that political power is not just expressed through the individual right to the vote, but that people were creative and expressing power and agency in other ways, which leads me to my next question, which is, sometimes the right to vote is considered an individual right, but often we hear people in the Black community, and particularly those Black women who you were pointing to earlier, who are really caught in the middle with the 15th Amendment. Do they support it because it's important to the men in their lives and their families to have that right to vote, or do they withhold their support because it didn't enfranchise women in America? So talk to us a little bit about the way in which African American communities thought about the right to vote as something larger than an individual right.
So in the era of emancipation, which includes roughly just before the American Civil War through Reconstruction, African Americans have a number of issues of political significance that they care about. And Black women are at the forefront of each of these issues, the most important of which is emancipation itself. But emancipation is, of course, a process. Yes, there's a moment of legal emancipation where someone is no longer enslaved but considered free, but defining what emancipation means is a much longer process, one that African Americans participated in very, very actively. Black women advocate alongside Black men for access to schools, for the building of religious institutions and the right to worship freely, something they had been denied under slavery. Access to marriage rights and the protections that legal marriage offers Black families and Black couples. They advocate for literacy. And all of these are done in the context of community. So when it comes to the vote, yes, of course, Black women want the vote, but they also are willing to advocate for kind of stepping stones to the expansion of the franchise. Many Black women are involved in union leagues, these organizations that register Black voters in high numbers in the American South. They go with men to the polling places, sometimes to actually protect them from violence at the polling places. They keep the institutions like Black churches and Black schools where political meetings can happen. They keep them up and running. They make sure that they're well maintained so they can actually house these kind of political activities. So while it's certainly true that Black women who certainly want the right to vote for themselves continue to be incredibly active in the women's suffrage movement, they're also able to, in the era of emancipation, participate in the expansion of the franchise in these community-based ways, that they see votes for Black men as votes that are going to help and protect the Black community.
My guest today has been Dr. Vanessa Holden, a historian at the University of Kentucky. Thanks so much for taking your time and for sharing this work with us.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.